Welcome everyone to Combox. I hope you can hear me. My mic decided to mute at a very weird time there. Rakshit might need to tell me if I'm actually working here. I think I'm here. Microphone's getting a bit touchy today. But welcome everyone to Combox, where the game lives on. I'm living on. My microphone may not be living on. This is Wagon Wheel, the show where we answer your questions on cricket in real time, if you ask them in real time. The best way to do that, if you're watching on YouTube or on Twitch, I don't even know. No, maybe you can't do this on Twitch yet. But if you can send a super chat on YouTube, then we can answer your questions. And most people, though, try and ask them on Patreon, which you can find at Good Areas Podcasts. You can sign up to a Patreon there and ask questions like PJ has. And he says, if Shane Warne doesn't miss a year of Test cricket because of his ban, how close does he get to Murali? That's a good question. He's got here that McGill took 53 wickets in those 11 Tests. So Warne was at, what, 708? Assuming that doesn't put more, like, finish his career earlier because he's putting more strain on his arm, shoulder, those sorts of things. Yeah, 53 and 11 Tests. Was it Bangladesh, Zimbabwe, India? Yeah, so he's probably around 55 to 60 in that time, and he's got 708, so he'd still would have been a fair way behind 800, I would have thought, at that point. Anil says, thoughts on the growth of non-leather ball cricket, like tape, tennis, etc. across the world. How much do spin-offs usually affect the primary sport elsewhere? I've got no issue with this. A lot of cricket fans over the years have complained about, you know, T20 cricket not being real cricket and everything else. I'm like, I think backyard cricket is real cricket, right? I think gully cricket is real cricket. Maidan cricket is real cricket. Street cricket is real cricket. You know, I grew up playing on synthetic pitches. That was real cricket to me. Indoor cricket. These are all real things. So I just want people to play cricket. I don't care if they do that. I don't think that tennis ball cricket or tape ball cricket are going to take off to the point where it causes us any issues. I think it can only be a strength for the game, the way that I look at it. I suppose the only argument you might have is the sort of, what, paddle or pickle situation if they got so big. But even then, I don't think I would see they cause other problems. Whereas, what, futsal or indoor football or whatever they call those sorts of things, I don't think there's any issues. So I'm not too worried about that. More people playing cricket. They can play cricket any way they want, and they can watch cricket any way they want. No issues here from me. Chris says, I've noticed a lot of Bangladesh players being dismissed to 125 to 130K short balls against Pakistan. Are they going to get creamed by Stark, Cummins, Hazelwood bowling at 140K later this year? It could have been the pitch. It could be dumb luck. It's not ideal when you're going to be going up against Australia. They should lose to Australia anyway, from that perspective. So I don't know if that's the thing I was looking at, Chris. I haven't looked as much at this game. I watched the previous game all on NV Play, but I haven't had a chance to watch this game on NV Play yet. So and been so busy with everything else. But I can have a look at that. I think they've always been. They've always struggled a little bit with the short ball because they do pull and hook quite recklessly at times. Having said that, they're also all really short, but the ball doesn't bounce in Bangladesh, right? So at least in India and Pakistan, you do sometimes, there are pitches that bounce. The pitches are getting fixed in Bangladesh and they seem to be getting a lot better over the last couple of years. But if you're a younger player, you've probably grown up without too much bounce. So that should be an issue for you against, you know, an Australian team or lots of the other teams. Ajit says, since IPL teams don't own their grounds in the first place, how does the alternate home venue selection work? Does the BCCI give them a shortlist? Are they allowed to give away any input preferences to the BCCI? And if it is just a case of the BCCI telling them what stadium to use, do you think this will be a problem in the future if a team builds a second stadium of their own? I would assume once teams have their own stadiums, we may not see this as much, unless we see like novelty games somewhere for some kinds of reasons. But yeah, I'd be pretty shocked if we do. I don't know how it works at the moment, Ajit. Actually, that's a really good question. I've never looked into it. I would assume that the owners probably say, we want to play in other places. And then the BCCI say, well, these are the grounds that have the facilities to be able to be played on. So I would assume it's like a conversation, but I don't know. It's a fascinating one, but it's not something I've really thought about for this question. Josh says, in T20s, do you think it would be a wise or silly idea for teams to intentionally play three specialist hyper-aggressive openers, Finn Allen? That way, if one gets out, you're still planning to destroy the power play. If you didn't lose any wickets, you're almost already won. This reminds me of the conversations we had a few years ago where, like, there were some analysts online going, everyone should just, like, pick players like Andre Russell. And I was like, great, where's the other Andre Russell? There aren't really three Finn Allens, right? Like, available for every team. So what you're looking at with Finn Allen is, let me just look at his overall record. I'm assuming he averages high 20s now in T20 cricket. I don't think he's got it over 30 yet, has he? Oh, 31. Okay, so it's a little bit higher than I thought. What you would find is, I think you could find maybe one other guy. Let's say you need 30 of them, right? You could probably find 10 to 15 of them who might be able to average over 27, 28. Another maybe 5 to 10 who can average around 20, you know, 25-ish. And then you'd find a bunch that will probably average anywhere from 18 to 22 is probably my guess. That's why we don't see it. It's not that teams wouldn't pick this because, you know, Finn Allen is a perfect example of a cricketer that, like, and, you know, this is kind of what Sunrisers are doing, right? They have Abhishek Sharma, Travis Head, and Ishan Kishan. So it gives them three opportunities to win the game with one player, right? And if two of them go at the same time, then you're kind of toast. And so it's not that easy to find that many of those players out there. And most of them are already in the IPL already. I'm trying to think if there's any that aren't. And internationally, kind of, you know, so what Australia probably wanted this of what? Marsh, McGurk, you know, I'm trying to think who the third one even would have been, like, right? There aren't that many of these kinds of players out there. But yeah, in a perfect world, I kind of think that you want your three Phil Salts at the top of the order if you have three Phil Salts, but most teams don't. Reece says, you've said before that you looked at plus years as a batter, that you figured out. Oh, okay, sorry. You said before that you've looked at how many plus years a batter has had with batting and that you figured out and calculated what a plus year for a bowler is. No, because we haven't got to that book yet. Actually, I've got to get back to Bloomsbury and talk to them about they did send me a contract, but then I don't know what happened with it. So I don't even have a contract there yet. No, we haven't really looked at that again. We would have to work it out. I would assume that you're probably, and this is just off the top of my head, Reece, for seamers, you're probably looking at something like any plus year is probably averaging under 30, I want to say. And any year under 25 is probably seen as a great year. But we might need to snippet that around a little bit. And then for spinners, we might change that to, 32 and 27, 28, something like that. That's what we did for the batting, by the way. So the numbers are slightly different for openers than they are for everyone else. So there's always a bit of a change between them. How much of your data is transferable in principle between the batting and the bowling books? Yeah, I think some of the overarching way that we looked at it is, like, we're looking at longevity, right? So I don't know where Courtney Walsh ends up, but Courtney Walsh has had one of the longest careers, a way longer career than Dale Steyn. You might still want Dale Steyn over him, which is absolutely fine, but Courtney Walsh has to come back into it from a longevity point of view. Jimmy Anderson as well, right? Those are two guys just off the top of my head that get bumped up. So those sorts of things I think we'd be definitely looking at. Home versus away is something that we talked about a lot. Being good in areas that you're not traditionally supposed to be good at, you know, that's, you know, for a lot of seamers and spinners, there's going to be a lot of stuff there. So I think a lot of the concepts will move over. Actual data, obviously, we'd probably just start again, but the concepts that we came up with, I'm trying to think of some of the other things we looked at, you know, what the other bowlers did in the games you were in, how good you were on the pitches where everyone was taking wickets compared to on the pitches that everyone wasn't taking wickets, how good you were for your era. All those sorts of things will definitely come across for the bowling book. Also, you know, with Jimenez and with Varun around as well, there might be some other concepts that we can bring in. I think Varun was involved in the batting book, but we kind of already done the heavy lifting sort of before he was at least full-time with Good Areas. Abe says, suppose Colpack didn't exist as an escape route for South African cricketers. Hopefully he still exists as a man, Abe. I hope you're not just killing this dude off. This isn't like one of those things where you go back in time with a time machine and kill Maros Kolpak. Would a fuller talent pool with guys like Abbott, Harmer, Russo, Olivier, and others have kept South Africa near the top of Test cricket for longer, especially after the great 2008-2014 side aged out? Or would the same sort of structural issues with Cricket South Africa have produced a similar decline anyway? It's a really fascinating one. I think the biggest problem that South Africa had was that once Callis couldn't bowl anymore, they could never really replicate that structure. And they seemed to be very keen on having the fifth bowling option available to them, meaning that they actually had a wicketkeeper in de Kock who could bat at number seven and be great, but they moved him to number six, which still gave them that sort of weakness. And then the bowlers they were picking, you know, Vian Mulder types, Steele Van Zyl types, I'm trying to think of some of the others who did that, weren't really adding that much with the ball, right? Certainly from a threat perspective. And they're also quite often just slower versions of the other kind of seam as they already had. So you're right, having more of that talent out there, I think the four guys you've mentioned would have been really crucial. But I actually think the bigger thing was that they never quite understood how to eat when Callis wasn't there. And, you know, I remember that, I think I covered the first series after Callis retired, or was it the second series after he retired, when, let me remember the full people involved, they replaced Callis with Ryan McLaren and Robin Peterson. I think that's right, isn't it? And so there you have two all-rounders on paper, but you don't really have, like, Ryan McLaren's probably a good number eight. Peterson's a number seven. And more of a part-time bowler at test level. And McLaren is a good bowler again, but maybe not quite a frontline test bowler. And so that player just didn't exist, right? Am I right with Robin Peterson? What did he take? Yeah, 38 wickets in 15 matches at 37. What was he in first class cricket? 33. Yeah. Right. So I know him. I just didn't want to insult him in case someone sent him this clip. Do not send him this clip. But really good players, and maybe one of them in the team might have made sense, but having both of them, and I think there was a long time where they weren't really sure what to do with that spot. That seemed to me a bigger issue than the depth, because they could still bowl teams out. But Harmer and Olivier specifically, I think are definitely, and probably Abbott as well, but are definitely test match bowlers that would have made it a deeper pool. But I didn't think the problem was always the deeper pool. I thought sometimes was they weren't picking like their best four frontline bowlers anyway. And so some of those guys wouldn't have been picked because they would have been trying to gerrymander another all-rounder or two in. Chris says, are local players worse than others at fielding the IPL, or does it just seem that way because there's more of them? Is that the cliche of Indian cricketers being bad at fielding coming back again? I've noticed that there's a couple of younger Indian players that don't look particularly good at fielding at the moment. But like Akshar Patel, Jadeja, Kohli, I mean, these are world-class fielders, right? So there's plenty of world-class fielders that are, like, Chakravarti is a terrible fielder, but is he that much worse than Mujeeb, right? Like, you know, if you have a bunch of spinners, you're going to get a bunch of Chahals and Mujeebs, right, in your spin fielders. So I think you're right when you say that the numbers are there. I don't think the overseas fielders have fielded particularly well this year. Bethel, Tim David, there's someone else that I wanted to, like, I don't think they've been as good. There's definitely a lot more attention on fielding in Indian cricket than there ever has been before, but I've still noticed, I've still never been around a cricket culture, I'll name the four cricket cultures off the top of my head, which is Zimbabwe, Australia, New Zealand, and England, New Zealand and South Africa, not England, where fielding is like such an important thing. That is not the case in a lot of other cricket cultures in general. So it's not just an Asian thing. You know, in England, it still shocks me how little fielding is done. When I would play, we would do our net sessions as early as possible in Australia and then do like double that amount of, you know, so if we did an hour and a half of net session, we'd then do another hour and a half of fielding. And when you weren't in the net session, you would be off doing regular fielding. My senior club, which is, you know, had overseas pros and it's not like a massive club in our part of town. I've never seen them do fielding practice. the seniors at the club in England. The last club I played at, I saw some, very little. So, I having been in India, I've seen similar things. I see everyone in the nets. I don't see that many people off working on their fielding all that much. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Master PPV says, is T20 cricket something that could have been come about and taken off in a world where internet and TV have total ubiquity? What do you think cricket would have looked like if T20 has been created, taken off sometime in the 60s or 70s? Well, I think actually what's fascinating about T20 cricket is it does kind of start early, right? Like, as in, I played T20 cricket when I was young. We just didn't call it that. But I played 20 and 25 over cricket. In England, it was quite a popular thing. I'm assuming a lot of junior cricketers around the world would have come up playing it. The big difference wasn't, I mean, the funny thing about T20 is it wasn't made for internet and TV, right? It was made to pack the grounds again. How do we give people a form of the game that feels like pure entertainment that takes up roughly the same amount of time that a football game will take? That was the idea. And it was made to give the counties money. So it actually wasn't invented for TV and the internet. It was invented to get people into grounds. And it was really successful at that. And then that combination of, you know, by that stage, cable TV had completely taken over. And then the internet, as you say, sort of follows probably off the back of that as well. So I think it would have been successful anytime. It was just one of those things of, we had, if you look at what England cricket had done, and England was obviously the most important place when it came to cricket by a long distance at that point, they had always played these one-day games. Now, that's not quite the case in some of the other cricket nations. Even in Australian club cricket, you would play two-dayers, right? You would play some one-dayers, but you play a lot of two-dayers. But if you go back and you'll see all these, like the West Indies playing, losing to Ireland in Sion Mills or whatever it was called. That's a one-day game. There were lots of these one-day games that were played. And so it probably made sense at that stage to fill out the whole day. And then this other format of cricket probably made more sense for juniors and then after school, after work type stuff. So maybe it took cricket a little bit longer to realize that. But once it did, the first part of it was not about TV or the internet. It was, you know, almost entirely, right, about just making sure that you filled grounds. So, yeah, I think it would still have taken hold earlier. James says, it seems like until a few years ago, more and more spin was being bowled in the power play. But that has gone back in the last 5 years, and it's currently almost all paces again. Is this accurate or am I imagining it? And if so, any idea why? I definitely think there's less spin bowled in the power play at the moment. I think we probably had an era where this is probably one of those cyclical things, James. Traditionally, most openers were good at playing the new ball or fast bowling, and that's why they opened the batting. And so it made sense at that point, the way that Martin Crowe did, what, 34 years ago, whenever it was, to go, okay, well, how are they going to play spin when they first face, right? Then there's probably also the matchup part of it, right? So, you know, a lot of teams had two right-handers or two left-handers because they weren't as conscious as all that, whereas teams are now trying to build better builds so that you can't do that. So there's a team, and I've now forgotten who it was. Oh, yeah, is it? So KKR have faced a lot of spin going up against them at the start. And that's because Finn Allen and Ajinkya Rahane, neither of them are, their specialty is spin, but also you can bowl one kind of spin bowling against them early on. We probably lost the wrist spinners who can bowl early on, which I think was Shadab a little bit, but it was Yasir Shah, Samuel Badri. Can't think of anyone else. But finger spinners are kind of struggling to get in the games anyway, James, now, right? And so I'm not saying there's less spin bowled altogether because I haven't looked this up. And I'd need to look up your numbers to have a look at it as well. But yeah, I think a lot of it is just teams are better set up for that now than they were probably when teams started doing this. But we'll try and do something on it if we can. I'll just send it off to Varun now and he can have a look at it as well. Only because it's very hard for me to do percentages while we're live on it. There's some stats I could look up and that one I can't. But yeah, I probably think it's that. I also think that teams never felt that comfortable bowling spin in the power play. And so any excuse not to do it, they went away from it. Ajit says, whenever I've seen clips on social media of practice or net sessions, it seems like every fast bowler is bowling a no ball. Not even marginal ones, big clear ones. Why is this the practice? And surely this has to affect their real game run up. No. To be honest, no balls are down globally and have been for years. It's certainly something that has been talked about quite a lot before. I'm kind of with you. I don't know what the right way around it is if we just stop them bowling no balls, but I'm with you. Also, quite often they bowl on mats and the mats move, so I don't even know if there even is a proper crease mark there, if that makes sense. But yeah, I shouldn't, if it was going to bother it, Ajit, I would assume that we are seeing more no balls bowled, and generally in cricket we've seen a lot fewer. I don't know about tests, but in T20 and ODI, since the free hit has come in, we've definitely seen it go down. Neil says, I totally get it's the gig and there's little cricket on elsewhere, but do you enjoy watching and covering the IPL given the volume of games? It's not really that much different to a World Cup for me. So, like, in terms of work, with the watch-alongs, it's been a little bit tricky. The problem with the IPL for me, I can actually explain this the best way, is the time zone is not particularly good for me because it's the end of the school day. So now the boys are a little bit older, that's fine, but there's a lot to do with Clementine. And then, you know, my wife also works, so there's dinners. I can't do Tuesday games because I've got the kids have tennis lessons. You know, all these little things that come up that are not always as much of a problem on some of the other things that we're talking about. You know, a test series is very different because I'm kind of taken away and then come back. I think that last year I really enjoyed covering it. This year, I'm finding it a little bit more struggling just because of the amount of games. But that would be the case if it's like, that's the case when I have to do four tests back to back to back to back, right? That's just a work issue. As far as enjoying it, yeah, I still enjoy it. I don't have any issue there. I've been covering the IPL one way or another since it started, right? So I'm used to covering it and I'm used to covering cricket. I do like it. I like the fact that there are repeatable narratives, that there are longer storylines. Some of the other leagues I struggle with a little bit because, you know, like the Punjab one this year, that happens in other leagues quite consistently, right? But it's a bit of a fluke happening in the IPL because the IPL is a bit longer than the other ones. Something as simple as that, I really enjoy. There's more to read on it and cover it and, you know, get behind it. I do enjoy it, but, you know, I mean, it's like anything. I would like to have a week off in the middle of it, right? Like maybe as it goes, especially as it gets longer, that's what I'll have to do. I think people like me and Rob Barron, and we're very, very similar in this way. We talked about this on a watch along, I think, recently. Neither of us are very good at taking days off. And the problem I have with the IPL or a World Cup is that I don't take days off and I don't factor days off beforehand, which I really should. And so it doesn't matter how much I'm enjoying the cricket or covering it really well. It's like at a certain point, you just lose the energy, right? I think that's probably been a bigger issue for me in an IPL, but that I get that in Ashes as well, like all these sorts of things. Sam says, are IPL matches getting too long and doesn't matter how long they are? I've watched every edition of the IPL since 2010 and at least 90% of the matches this season. I'm a cricket addict. Yes, you should see someone. I remember when T20 games were first played in 2003, I managed to record the whole game on a standard VHS tape for a school friend who didn't have satellite television. I understand with the sponsorship, strategic timeouts and reviews, it all adds up to time onto the game. It's quite a long evening for the fans. Yeah, I've actually talked about this quite a lot before, Sam, and it's fascinating. I probably need to talk to someone like Suresh Menon. I definitely don't mean Suresh Menon. God, I've forgotten his name. I need to talk to someone like Justin Gill or Lalit Modi or Andrew Wildblood or someone like that. And there's another obvious name I've just forgotten. And I had a meeting with this guy recently as well. I can't remember his name. Anyway, someone who's worked on it to understand. My worry has always been that the games finish so late, and that's quite often when the most memorable things happen, right? You can have a boring game that ends exciting and everyone loves it. Are we creating a situation in the IPL where we're missing the virality of that moment because the games finish so late? I think from a sponsor perspective and everything else, as you said, I can kind of see why an IPL game can go for 4 hours. But I just worry that too many of the best moments are finishing very, very late when people are already half dozing off or falling asleep or anything else. You know, Indian culture is very different when it comes to when you wake up. And like most of my Indian friends seem to be awake later than I am in the UK. But do you know what I mean? Like the kind of core audience, this sort of casual fan, you don't want them to miss all the good endings. That's always been my concern with it. I think in other leagues in the world, you want it to be more strict to the 3 hour point. But yeah, these games are, someone who does the watch alongs, they are ridiculous sometimes. Gaji says, do international cricketers get media training? Also, can players be punished for out of field behavior? Definitely can be punished for out of field behavior. They are quite regularly. Yeah, they get media training. Most international players will get it. I don't think it's very good. I don't think that people really understand. The problem with media training in general is most people are trained to not really engage with the media properly and to give answers that don't really help. So you end up in a situation where the players are not themselves. The media doesn't get anything out of it and the player doesn't get anything out of it, right? And that's the opposite. And the sport doesn't get anything out of it. It's like, well, that's not how I would do it, right? A lot of the other problems are press conferences are the worst things in the world, and players, you know, outside of captains and coaches, really shouldn't be involved in press conferences all that much. So I think that's a big issue. There's no way, and I've done press conferences as a person before, there's no way for it not to be like a defensive thing. It's just, they're terribly set up. I think the best media training I've seen probably of recent times would be, I think the South Africans were really good. I don't know if that was Sipakazi before she went to the ICC, but there might have been a few people there. There's another woman who was involved with them. I felt like the players felt like humans. And also they were easier to access in a way that felt comfortable for them and the journalist. And they gave proper answers. Like if you asked them something, they gave you answers. I thought under Danny Rubin, I thought the England men's team had been really good. Also the England women's team, although my friend was running that, so maybe that's, I'm a little bit biased. But mostly I think that they're trying to not give the right answers. Or I actually think it should be, what are you trying to get out of being in the media, right? Like what you've got to do these interviews. What are you trying to get out of it? This is what the team wants to get out of it. This is what the board wants to get out of it. This is what the media wants to get out of it. What do you want to, that's the best way of dealing with these things, of being like, you know, I remember there was a guy that used to run Queensland's press, so Brisbane Heat in Queensland. And I've forgotten his name. I always thought he was really good because I remember calling him up once and telling him what I needed. And he was the first guy. I was like, oh, okay, you don't want to talk to that guy then. I think what you really need is if you talk to this guy and ask him these questions. And then he went back to the player and he said, he's going to ask you specifically about this. Make sure that you've got something good for him, right? And the whole thing just worked brilliantly. And he understood what I was trying to do. And too often, there are too many press officers are trying to be too defensive and it doesn't really work. So you really do need to train the players in to be like, what do you actually want your public persona to be? And you see this, Gaji, sometimes with celebrities in like documentaries and stuff. You'll see like PR people and marketing people talk to them and go, what do you want this to be? And my understanding, and having been in cricket a long time, is those conversations are very rarely had with these players. And so you end up with like a Graham Swan situation where Graham Swan's trying to be Graham Swan and the ECB's trying to stop Graham Swan from being Graham Swan. And I actually wrote a paper for the ECB because they asked me to do it. And in it, I was like, what are you doing? Like, this is your best marketing tool at the moment. So I think we're getting towards that place a little bit more. But specifically, players now are now dealing with this through PR agencies, through agents, through managers, and they're understanding that. It's very rare I talk to a player or a former player now, and we're not talking about brand awareness, where you're trying to position yourself, who you're trying to be, how you feel comfortable. That's very common now. I don't remember almost any of that when I started. Mob says, Charles Barkley has recently come out smashing homophobic society after the death of Jason Collins. Can you please share your thoughts here, perhaps going into the discrepancies between gay populations in men's cricket? 0%. It's not zero, is it? But 0.01%. Women's cricket, 25%, as per The Guardian, Outsports, and the general population of 2 to 4%. Yeah, I'll tell you a story. I wrote a piece, and I'm not even sure it was my point. Someone might have even made it to me. Might have even been a player. But when Steve Davies came out, and so he's the only major male player that I'm aware of who's come out. He was playing for England, the wicketkeeper batter, you know, very talented, hard hitter of the ball. When he came out, I remember like looking into the laws in all the different countries in cricket and being like, half the places he can tour, he can't take his partner and feel comfortable, right? In some of those places, it was even worse than that. You know, we're talking about, you know, this was, would have been what, you know, things like UAE, wouldn't have been Pakistan because I don't think Pakistan were available there. I can't remember what, you know, India, Sri Lanka, parts of the West Indies still had those laws, right? Not to mention just socially in some cricket places, it wasn't particularly well-respected. So there's no doubt that, like, that was a chance that we had. There are other gay cricketers that are in the closet, and some of which who may never come out, some of which who have probably passed away, I think, who never came out, and it was quite well known. There are bisexual cricketers. I'm talking about the men here specifically. And it's just not something it's very rarely talked about. And it's always dealt with a little bit uncomfortable, in an uncomfortable way. Whereas women's cricket just feels so much more open and easy to deal with these sorts of situations. But, you know, there's still been issues there between them. There's also, hilariously in women's cricket, there's dating between teams, right? You know, I don't want to out anyone who's not out publicly or relationships that aren't known about, but there has been quite a bit of dating between teams, even before franchise leagues came about. I'm assuming I haven't been on the women's circuit for ages. I'm assuming it's even more happening now. I've just always found women's cricket much more enjoyable space. That cricketers are more relaxed. They're usually much bigger cricket nerds. So they're happy to talk about the minutiae. It feels like a more welcoming, comforting, fun place to be in. And I do think a big part of that is that most people can be themselves a little bit more in those environments. So yeah, you know, that's my memory of it or my understanding of it. You know, I remember having a conversation with a bunch of people about this, one of which I believe was an in cricketer and at an event. And he was sort of, there was another person there who tangentially involved with cricket, but a very well-known gay person. And we're having this conversation and one of them's like, don't you think Jared, or the guy who was outside of cricket, or sort of roughly related to cricket, would say, don't you think, Jared, every player should come out as gay? And I was like, well, obviously in a perfect world, that's what we would want, but it's going to be, you know, there are so many different pressures and blah, blah, blah. And then the other guy's like, don't you think, Jared, that it's up to every individual person? And there's an element of it. I agree with both of those sides, but until we make it more normal, right, it does cause issues. Right? And so at a certain point, I just wish everyone could come out, but I understand that's not the world that we live in and not everyone is comfortable with that. And, you know, I've had friends who've been in the closet for a long period of time. I know people who've never really ever come out in the whole time I've known them, despite the fact I've known they've been gay, right? And so I obviously am on the side of them, but I'm also on their side if they don't want to come out. Like, it's a tricky situation. It shouldn't be, but that's where we are. Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today. Hurt says, Pat Cummins deflects pitch reading questions at the toss with that trademark grin and essentially admits he can't predict surface behavior. But given enough historical data, resources, money, visuals, and analytical rigor, could we build a model that does? One that reasonably predicts pitch behavior before a single ball is bowled? Or are there simply too many interacting variables for any model to ever get there? I don't think there's a model that could ever do it. Maybe if we could X-ray a surface, and we X-rayed like enough surfaces around the world and we got all the data and we matched it with like Hawkeye data, we could do something. I don't think that's the case. It won't matter in the future anyway, Hurts, because T20 cricket will probably be played on hybrid pitches. But yeah, I think we can get better. I don't think we can ever get 100%. Ali says, what made Dale Steyn so good? Would his deliveries as they existed then still be good in today's seam era, or would batters be dominating him? So Dale Steyn had what, you know, the method that he had is kind of, it's not exactly Malcolm Marshall or Richard Hadlee, but there's a bit of elements of both. And why those guys were such unique killing machines is the ability to keep the stumps in play for bold and LBW, but also regularly get outside edges. So it's very hard for an outswing bowler to bowl really straight, because if you get it slightly wrong, it darts down the leg side. So to be able to do that consistently is the dream ball. So if you go back, there's some great footage of Damien Fleming bowling to England. I think it was at the MCG, going back a few years ago, where he's basically bowling huge hooping outswingers that are angling down the leg side, pitching on the stumps, and then straightening. So you've got LBW bowled and caught behind, caught slips, all in play. All four deliveries at the same, all four major dismissal types at the same time. And if you look at Steyn, he doesn't quite swing it in the way that Hadlee or Kapil Dev or Damien Fleming or someone like that did, but he swung it a lot. And so he keeps that. And he could control it, so it didn't slip down the leg side as much. Then he also had the pace of Malcolm Marshall. But the difference between him and Marshall and a lot of those other bowlers is most other faster bowlers are getting more bounce than those guys, right? So Marshall and Steyn are keeping the stumps in play twice. The away movement that is pitching on the stumps, and they can both move the ball back in as well if they want to go in that direction. But let's just stay with the away ones as well, which means that it's not bouncing over all that much. It's hitting the stumps. And to go back to Fleming, I don't know how tall Richard Hadlee was, but if you go back to someone like Fleming, Fleming isn't a particularly tall bowler, right? And Dale Steyn's not a particularly tall bowler, and Malcolm Marshall's not. So again, you've got all that. So if you put those same skill sets in Ian Bishop, right, who had a lot of the same skill sets we're just talking about here, he's going to get wickets, but in another way. And the vast majority of Ian Bishop's wickets, unless he's really pitching up, are going to be caught behind and caught and keeper. Well, that's two different kinds of dismissals. Marshall and Steyn can add the other two as well. I think that's a big part of it. Then you've got the accuracy at pace. And I think that's a huge amount of it. And also, I'm not sure what his like secondary, like he's, I think Steyn is maybe a little bit like Rabada, more of a swing bowler than a seam bowler. But it's not that, it's that they're probably not like S tier level on skills of anything compared to some of the other guys we just mentioned, Marshall and Richard Hadlee and those sorts of guys. But there's actually lots of ways that Dale Steyn can get you out at pace. So he doesn't have to be like a surgeon as consistently, because if he's bowling the ball at the top of leg stump, right? And if it straightens a little bit, he's got a bold LBW chance. And if it straightens a little bit more, he hits the top of off stump. So he's not surgical in the way that Pat Cummins is, right? It's a perfect example of that. But it doesn't matter, because Dale Steyn's doing so much with the ball that he's he, a bit like with Rabada, that he just needs to be there and thereabouts consistently. On top of that, he's an incredible athlete and he can bowl very fast for long periods of time. I would assume he was very smart as well. I wish he would talk in his way through the wickets a little bit more, but I feel like he was a very smart bowler. Maybe it wasn't as obvious as it was with other guys because him and Rabada are so naturally talented that sometimes you can't see that. But I assume he was very smart as well. So again, he might not be S-level smart, but if he's A-level smart and he's got all these other things going for him, that's great. If he's A-level accurate, right? And for a swing bowler, he might have even been slightly even higher than that, right? But A-plus level accurate, that's huge. He can move the ball in both directions. He can reverse swing it. Like, you just keep laying on all the skills that he had. Like, that's an incredible bowler. I'm really glad to ask that. Neil says, saw Hasan Cheema is back in the PSL managing a team. How much did Pakistan actually listen to him and utilize him as his time as analyst selector? Look, it's a frustrating job. And I don't want to, I think that's best for Hasan Cheema, and I'll get him on a podcast soon. We obviously, talk from time to time. And I don't think I've ever got him on a podcast, which is silly. Lovely guy, you know, met him years ago. Been following his career even before that. So I tell you what, Neil, I'll try and get him on. But yeah, it goes up and down. Sometimes they listen to you and then it doesn't work and they stop listening to you. Sometimes they don't listen to you three times in a row and you're right. And then they listen to you the fourth time and it doesn't work and it gets all murky. It's a complicated world. I think there were people within, PCB's a mess, but I do think there were people within PCB who understood it needed to be fixed. I'm not sure they tried to fix it the right way and there's so many other issues, but I'm sure he's been... There aren't many analysts I've ever talked to. Nathan Lehman always seems really positive. Most other analysts I've ever talked to always feel a little bit frustrated because it's a weird job at the end of the day. PJ says, if New Zealand or South Africa win the 1992 World Cup or 96, how does that impact cricket's popularity in those countries? Or does cricket forever remain second fiddle to rugby in both nations? Ooh. I don't think it changes in New Zealand. I wonder what would have happened in South Africa. When does South Africa win Rugby World Cup? It's not second fiddle in South Africa, though. It's third fiddle, isn't it? Behind football as well. South Africa Rugby World Cup first win. So that's 1995. They've got the Mandela thing happening there too, don't they? It was a fairly white side, wasn't it, 95? I don't know much about rugby. My memory is it was fairly white side as well. But Mandela wasn't in Melbourne or in Australia. There's something about the fact that the other one happened in South Africa. I don't think cricket flips rugby in South Africa, and it definitely doesn't in New Zealand. But it would be much bigger in both, I think, 100%, but I don't think it flips either, based on what I know of both those cultures. Reece says, where do you see very grassroots cricket, for example? I know you played in the Kent League before. Will there be divisions? Where do you see very grassroots cricket, for example? I know you played in the Kent League. Yeah, I played in the Kent League. Will there be divisions 13, 12, and 11 in 10 years? And will there be enough clubs? So from what I understand in the Kent area, and I can't speak for all of London because I'm not as on it as I used to be, but from what I understand in the Kent area is we have so many teams and so many extra juniors coming through at the moment. So New Beckenham, I think when I signed up with New Beckenham, I signed the kids up first. I don't think I started playing straight away. But when I signed the kids up, we had a situation where there was, like, my boys both went straight into the 11 because there weren't enough players. And I don't think either of my boys have played with hardball, but they had to come straight in. They were fine with hardball. They just hadn't played games with it before. So I brought them straight in. And now I think there are multiple cricket teams in almost every age group at New Beckenham and all the other teams around here, which are much stronger on juniors and have been doing it more consistently over the last couple of years, seem to have just junior teams coming out their ass. Senior teams, I think last year at our club, they could have had five senior teams and maybe they have two Sunday teams. So that's like seven teams. So it feels in this part of town, and this is a very cricket part of London, this sort of southeast tip. So I don't know if that's the case across London everywhere, but it feels like something, it does feel like something's happening. All Stars is making a massive change in the UK, which is, you know, something they took from the old Milo cricket programs in Australia. That's huge. I'm noticing it more all the time. I think the All Stars at New Beckenham sold out so quickly that I didn't even sign up straight away, and they had to sign me up because they needed me to help coach. So like, please sign up your daughter so you can come and help us. So that's how, and I've heard that with a lot of All Stars. Again, this is this area. It feels to me at the moment, the combination of 100 and All Stars has changed things a little bit, but I don't know if I'm just in a bit of a cricket bubble with that. But yeah, from where I am, it seems like there's a lot going on, but I haven't looked into it as much as I had been, Ruth. Abe says, Martin Crowe was arguing as early as 2009 for something like a World Test Championship at a time when T20 had just begun to reshape cricket's economics and schedules. Here's a what if. Had Crowe's idea been adopted around 2009, would it have given bilateral tests enough context and narrative stakes to slow down the so-called decline of Test cricket? Or perhaps the forces pulling cricket toward the franchise T20 were already too strong. Yeah, once the owners had come in, there was nothing that could be done. But there is no decline in Test cricket. Test cricket is bigger now, Abe, than it's ever been. It's just that we have another form of cricket that's way bigger than it. So there isn't... The last couple of years of Test cricket have been as healthy as they have ever been. Viewership, interest, articles, you name it, right? Maybe not in crowd, but maybe, you know, that could be the T20 impact as well. But we also play Test cricket at weird times of the day. But I think Test cricket is actually really healthy at the moment. It's just that no one's in charge of it. And so we're not really capitalizing on what has been, three or four of the best years in Test cricket's history. But yeah, what should have happened in around 2009, which is when I think this all started, was we should have sold international cricket as an overall product the way that we do, you know, the IPL or World Cups. And we should have had divisions at that stage. It should have started around that period. We would be in such a stronger position if we'd done that. Sam says, do you think the fielding restrictions in women's cricket should now be the same as the men's? I understand what they initially decided to make to encourage attacking play, but given how the women's game has progressed, is there any need for it anymore? And a semi-related point on fields, I'd like the broadcasters to keep the field graphic on the screen at all times. You and me and everyone else, especially now so much commentary is done around, even TV commentary now is done off tube. We don't know where the fielders are. None of us know where the fielders are. You notice if I'm on a watch along how often I will call the field out when I know where they are, just because it's not even for the audience at that point. It's for me, so I can give context. Someone hits a huge shot on the offside. Suryavanshi hit this lovely push on the offside the other day, and I called it like it was a single because I thought they had a deep point out, and they didn't, and it was a four, and I didn't have any of the energy of the four. It was such a beautiful shot. I feel like I underplayed it. Anyway, so the second part I agree with. First part, we've had a huge boom. I think I might have just done, it might have been in one of the Bowlpocalypse pieces, Sam. You can actually see how much quicker women's cricket is getting. I still think they probably want it to be a little bit more high scoring before we start to cap it. But yeah, we will eventually, within the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to have to rethink if the circle is the right size. And we're going to have to rethink how many players go out outside the circle. I think that's very fair. I mean, I think, Sam, the best thing that could happen really now is for women's cricket to break away from men's cricket right at the moment and go out on their own. Mob says, if you had to choose between the highest total cricket value, TCV, for any two cricketers that share the same name or thereabouts, who is that pair? Oh, Imran Khan's, Bert Sutcliffe's, Ollie Robertson's, Brendan McCullum's. I think it's the two Sutcliffe's, isn't it? I think I would go the two Bert Sutcliffe's. One's a Herbert and one's a Bert. Does that count, Mob? Isn't it? Or are they both the same? I thought there was different spelling on the Bert. Maybe I'm just misremembering. Or there's something like that anyway. I know one was named after the other one, but yeah, I would go Bert Sutcliffe's. I think we had two, one all-time great and one great from one country. And I don't see anywhere else on that list where you have the same. Ali says, let's just assume all franchise owners have completely taken over the cricket calendar. I'm not sure we have to assume that. It's kind of here. What would international cricket look like outside of white ball tournaments? And is there a pathway for teams like Brazil, Egypt, and Japan? That will be World Cups and everything else. Yeah, I think what we will, I think there'll still be a chance for international bilateral cricket, but it will probably be more friendly based. And then there might be some more tournaments. I think that would bring about hopefully more qualifying tournaments where major teams could play as well, which would be helpful. But yeah, there's actually already heaps of windows available for tournaments and qualifying tournaments and all these sorts of things. So I think they will probably stick in. But yeah, it will be more like football or basketball or rugby, where the main sport will be team franchise based, and everything else will be a little bit will be World Cups and you know, I don't know, well, what else they have, the Six Nations, is that, you know, those sorts of things will come in. There's still a lot of money to be made from international cricket. The question is when that flips, and it doesn't matter that it, you know, what happens there. But I would assume bilateral cricket will die. That doesn't mean that international cricket dies. Test cricket might stay on, but be league-based. It may even be franchise-based, but league-based. That's the way forward around that, because you could sell that. You could sell a league for lots of money. The problem with test cricket at the moment and with bilateral ODIs and T20s is you don't actually make that much money from them, because you sell them as in groups of three and six. TV companies don't give a shit about that. They want 20, 40, 50, 60 days of content. What about 300 days of content? We could sell you all in one package and you get the home team for this many days. That's the way it should be done. All right, let's just see if there's any super chats or anything in here. Oh, Jessica coming in like a champion, as always. Thank you very much. Suhas says, do you think we'll ever see a switch hitter? Yeah, I think we might. I do think there's a possibility for that. I think it's probably more likely, Suhas, that we see them against spin in the way that, so David Warner's done this a little bit, right? He's like lined up as a right-hander at times against off spin, I think. Obviously, Sunil Gavaskar did it all those years ago as well in the Ranji game. So I do think we'll see that. I'm not sure we'll see it as much for against quick bowling in the way that baseball does it. But I can see against, I can see a possibility of that happening. I've been pretty strong on this for years, that I kind of believe that we stand on the wrong side of the bat anyway. And so that cricket is, and I think the reverse sweep has shown us this as much as anything, that cricket is actually a more of a two-handed sport. So I can certainly see how this would be the case. I don't think I would feel comfortable lining up as a left-hander, but I feel very comfortable reverse sweeping as the bowler is coming in. And so I think if I came through cricket now with the same kind of background I had, I'm not saying I would do it or have the skills to pull it off, but I think I'd try it occasionally against left-arm finger spinners. I can see that. I could see that happening. So yeah, I do think we'll see that. Having said that, if you'd asked me 20 years ago, if by now more fielders would have been throwing with their left and right arms, I would have said they do in the ring, like short stabby throws. And we still don't see many players do that. So maybe there's just a reason why you can't do it. But I feel in batting, it's not quite as strong. But yeah, there we have it. Thank you very much. I think the IPL game's on now, so you can all head over to our watch along. But thank you to everyone who was in the chat today and everyone on Patreon for all of your support. We'll see you again. Well, I mean, we'll see you right now. We're literally just on the other channel. Just go there. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Rakshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.